Welcome to today's deep dive. We have a really fascinating one for you today, exploring this wild tension between, well, pure material chaos and the incredibly deep meanings we love to project onto it.
Right, because we are desperate for meaning, honestly.
Exactly. And our case study for this is a 2021 abstract painting by Jaira Duca called Adolescente. But before we get into the art, I want you to imagine a scenario. So you're walking down a city street, right?
Okay, I'm picturing it.
You're lost in thought, maybe a little distracted, and you just happen to glance over at this old, damp concrete wall in some alleyway.
Yeah.
And right there, right in the middle of this massive, irregular water stain, you see a face, not just a smudge. You see a distinct profile.
Oh, totally. Like seeing shapes in clouds.
Right. You see the hollow of an eye, maybe the slope of a nose, a mouth turning down. And suddenly you just stop walking. You're standing there constructing this entire, you know, emotional narrative about this face. You sense melancholy. You sense a whole story.
Which is such a uniquely human thing to do.
It really is. But if we force ourselves to just take a step back and be brutally objective for a second, there is literally nothing on that wall but water, salt, and deteriorating concrete.
Yeah, that bizarre phenomenon where we essentially force profound meaning onto meaningless chaos, that is called pareidolia, and it's incredibly powerful.
The psychological thing, right?
Well, it's actually an evolutionary survival tactic. If you think about early human history, you know, out on the savanna, our brains became hardwired to find familiar patterns, especially faces in random stimuli, like tall grass or shadows.
Because if you miss a face in the tall grass, you might get eaten.
Exactly. If you saw a vague shape and assumed it was a predator, you survived. We are essentially the descendants of paranoia pattern recognizers. It's the mind's way of trying to order a natural world that is, by its very definition, completely unpredictable.
So projecting meaning makes us feel safe.
Yes, exactly. We want to feel safe.
Which brings us to the core debate of today's deep dive. Because that evolutionary glitch, it doesn't just happen on damp alley walls. It sits at the absolute center of the controversy surrounding Duke's painting, Adolescente.
Right, because what happens when that chaotic stain isn't just a random accident of nature, but a piece of modern abstract art?
And not just any art, but a piece where the artist hands you this highly specific, emotionally loaded title right out of the gate. I mean, we really have to ask, does a painting like Adolescente genuinely capture the visceral struggles of modern youth?
Or, and this is the big question, is that title just like an intellectual straitjacket forced onto a purely physical accident of spilled paint?
It's such a huge debate. It's really the ultimate battle between visual form and the written word.
It is. Because when an artist gives you that word adolescente, the entire dynamic of human perception just shifts. The physical reality of the piece, which we have to remember is just, you know, pigments and polymers drying on a canvas, it completely vanishes from your conscious thought.
You stop seeing the paint entirely.
Right. It immediately gets replaced by your own psychological projections.
Yeah.
And those projections are now being heavily steered by the artist's narrative anchor.
So before we can even try to understand what the painting means, we have to look at exactly how it was born, because the process is wild. We are in Duke's studio in Whittier, California.
Yeah, the environment is key here.
It totally is. He's not like standing at an easel, meticulously mixing oils and painting a literal portrait of a teenager.
Yeah.
He is using Fluid Liquitex acrylic, and he is just pouring it directly onto the canvas.
It means there are zero reference images. I mean, zero structural planning. There's no underlying sketch.
Just paint and gravity.
Exactly. This is an exercise in the fluidity of the material interacting with gravity and the physical surface of the canvas. It's pure physics.
Right. But, and this is a crucial detail from the sources, as that fluid acrylic was moving and shifting completely on its own, a distinct shape emerged in the pooling paint, a disfigured profile of a face.
The pareidolia kicks in.
Yeah, but the artist consciously made the decision not to erase it. He didn't pour over it or tilt the canvas to destroy it. He kept it. And to me, that kind of proves the metaphor isn't totally forced.
How so?
Well, it organically emerged from the process. Capturing this specific distorted face perfectly mirrors the reality of youth today. Feeling completely overwhelmed, fractured, and utterly alone, even when you're standing in the middle of a crowded room.
See, it's a beautiful thought. But what's fascinating is how your interpretation there perfectly illustrates the psychological trap of pareidolia.
Wait, really? A trap?
Oh, absolutely. By taking a piece generated purely by the gravity-driven movement of fluid paint and then slapping such a loaded title onto it, the artist is essentially taking a conceptual shortcut.
A shortcut? But he saw the face, he recognized the emotion, and he preserved it. It's a curated accident.
Materially speaking, it is a stain. It's literally just a stain of Liquitex.
Oh.
It is you, the viewer, primed by the title, who assigns that specific patch of dried polymer the fragility, the intensity, and the overwhelm of adolescence.
So the paint didn't decide to be an angst-ridden teenager.
No. The paint is just paint. The artist saw a shape, recognized that humans are desperate for meaning, slapped a label on it, and basically let human psychology do all the heavy lifting.
That is wow.
I mean, if he had named it Dying Flower, you would probably be sitting here telling me how the distorted face represents the wilting petals of spring, you know.
Okay, wow. Fair point.
Yeah.
So maybe the shape of the face was an accident of gravity, and maybe we are projecting onto it, but surely the intense visual experience of the colors themselves isn't an accident.
The palette is definitely intense, I'll give you that.
It's not a subtle palette at all. You have these vibrant, almost violently clashing neon greens, deep yellows, blood reds, pitch blacks, and they are all fiercely fighting for space on the canvas.
They really are.
Doesn't that incredibly aggressive palette prove there is a specific commentary on youth happening here?
Well, the palette is undeniably aggressive. It's super saturated and excessive. But the real question is whether that aggression is sociological or if it's purely chemical.
Let's explore the sociological side first, because the sources provide an incredibly intense interpretation of this visual chaos.
Yeah, the societal reading is very heavy.
It is. Think about what young people are actually dealing with right now, today. Materially, a lot of youth might have their basic needs met. They have roofs over their heads, iPads, high-speed internet.
Right, the surface-level comforts.
Exactly. But beneath that veneer of comfort, they are facing this profound, systemic, almost suffocating loneliness.
A completely isolated generation surrounded by connectivity.
A massive vacuum of genuine connection. And look at the family dynamics driving this, which the source material touches on. You have a situation where many of these kids are essentially being raised by care workers.
Right. Often undocumented immigrants who are...
Yes, who are silently carrying and managing their own intense family traumas, geopolitical anxieties, just to survive.
While the actual parents are completely focused elsewhere.
Totally absent from the emotional core of the home. They are climbing the corporate ladder, building businesses. So you have this isolated kid staring through glowing screens at a world that feels ravaged not by culture or civilization, but by forever wars and pure corporate greed.
It's just an endless intake of toxic information.
Exactly. The argument is that these contradictory, chaotic colors, the fierce reds and heavy blacks physically fighting the sickly yellows and greens, perfectly reflect this depressed, bombarded state of modern youth. The visual matches the feeling completely.
It absolutely matches the feeling. It's a very compelling interpretation. But if we want to be rigorous about this, we have to look at the materialist counterargument.
Okay, hit me with the chemistry.
Well, the cause of that visual chaos is purely chemical. You are attributing incredibly complex geopolitics, late-stage capitalism, and nuanced family dynamics to the behavior of shifting paint.
But isn't that what art is supposed to do? Use material to express the complex.
Yes, but you have to understand the actual mechanics of the medium. Think about the physical nature of poured acrylic. If you've ever poured a vinaigrette and watched the oil and vinegar fight, you understand fluid dynamics.
Oh, like how they separate and push against each other.
Exactly. When you mix different synthetic and organic pigments in Liquitex, they possess different specific gravities. Iron oxide black is literally molecularly heavier than a synthetic yellow.
So the heavy colors literally sink.
They physically sink to the bottom,
mm-hmm.
displacing the lighter colors and forcing them up to the surface. And furthermore, as the polymers in the acrylic react with the air and begin to cure, they expand.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they trap microscopic air bubbles. They push against each other. So that sense of visual agony or the feeling that the colors are overwhelmed and violently fighting for space.
Yeah.
That belongs entirely to the chemical properties of the material. It's molecular displacement, not juvenile existentialism.
So you're saying the material is just doing what material does, and we are projecting an entire sociology textbook onto a chemical reaction.
Precisely. To say the paint is expressing the trauma of absentee parenting severely underestimates the role of physical material accident. The acrylic is responding to the laws of physics, not to the evening news.
That is, I mean, that makes total sense.
The greens and blacks aren't fighting because of global wars, you know. They are fighting because one is denser than the other.
Okay, I see your chemistry argument. I really do. The internal struggle of the paint is driven by gravity and polymers. But what about the external boundaries holding it all in?
You mean the frame?
The literal frame of the canvas. Because there is a really vivid analogy used in the sources to defend the painting's narrative, focusing specifically on the limits of the space.
The spatial boundaries of the wood and the stretched cotton.
Right. So imagine grabbing five highly energetic, angst-filled teenagers and shoving them all into a tiny 1x1 meter steel elevator.
That sounds terrifying.
Right. The unbearable, suffocating tension in that scenario doesn't just come from the teenagers fighting with each other. It comes from the fact that the steel walls are absolute. They will not yield no matter how hard you push.
Okay, I see where this is going.
It is argued that the physical edge of Duke's canvas acts exactly like those unyielding steel walls. It perfectly symbolizes the claustrophobic societal pressures and the narrowing, highly restricted reality that a young person feels today. The frame isn't just wood, it's their societal prison.
I will admit, the elevator metaphor is visually striking. It genuinely makes you feel the claustrophobia right in your chest.
It really does.
But we have to ask how much we are romanticizing the literal mundane tools of art creation. And I'm going to respectfully dismantle that beautiful metaphor using a really fascinating discrepancy in the technical data from the sources.
Oh, wait, what discrepancy?
Well, if you look at the official catalog notes for the exhibition, the dimensions of Adolescent TR are listed as 20x10 inches.
Mm-hmm.
But in some of the critical analysis exploring this exact societal prison metaphor, it cites the piece as being approximately 10x8 inches.
Oh, okay, so it's a typo in the catalog, or maybe the critic was looking at a different study. What does that change?
It changes everything about the intent, because it reveals that romanticizing the edge of a canvas as a metaphor for youth is a purely retroactive justification.
How so?
Let's go back to the physics of poured liquid. It does not matter if the canvas is 10x8 inches, 20x10 inches, or the size of a football field. Fluid paint, when poured and left to expand, will eventually hit an edge.
Well, yeah.
That is simply the nature of pouring liquid onto a bounded surface. Surface tension builds at the lip. The narrowing and the restriction belong strictly to the physical wooden frame. They do not belong to a corner generation.
Wait, no, I have to push back on that. You are being entirely too literal here.
Am I?
Yes. Just because a canvas naturally has physical edges doesn't mean an artist can't use those edges metaphorically. I mean, why does the physical reality of a wooden frame automatically negate the emotional resonance of feeling trapped?
It doesn't negate the emotion you feel. But if we call that physical boundary a societal prison, we are, again, doing all the heavy lifting for the artist.
I don't know. I feel like that's just the nature of art.
But a canvas has to end somewhere, right? If the paint didn't stop at the edge, it would just be a puddle on the floor of the Whittier studio. Ascribing deep sociological claustrophobia to the simple fact that a painter didn't want to ruin his floor is an enormous leap of faith.
Wow. You really give no quarter to the narrative, do you?
I'm just advocating for the physical reality of the paint.
Fair enough. Fair enough. So if the face is a pyridolic stain, the chaotic colors are just molecular density, and the claustrophobic edge is just a piece of wood, what does this all mean for the painting as a whole?
That is the million-dollar question.
To truly evaluate if Adolescente is a standalone sociological masterpiece, or if it's just a brilliant exercise in human projection,
mm-hmm.
We have to look at what Duke did next. We have to look at the rest of the series.
Yes. This is where the entire debate really flips on its head.
It totally does, and honestly, it completely threw me when I learned this. The subsequent paintings in this exact same poured acrylic series, created with the exact same fluid Liquitex technique, the same chaotic process, the same visual language.
Yep.
They are named after towns in the Valle del Cauca region of Colombia, random towns, places like Buga or Palmira.
Right. Not exactly carrying the heavy existential weight of a title like Adolescente.
No, yeah. Not at all. And if you are a viewer who just spent 20 minutes crying in front of Adolescente because it perfectly captured the tragic isolation of modern youth, what are you supposed to do with that information?
It's very jarring.
If the very next painting, which looks stylistically identical, is just named Palmira, mm-hmm. Does that mean the profound emotional connection was a total fabrication? Was it just a conceptual game all along?
It definitely raises those questions.
Honestly, knowing the next painting is named after a random Colombian municipality almost strips away the visceral experience of the first one. It kind of makes me feel like I was tricked. Like the artist was laughing behind the canvas.
I can completely understand why it feels like a manipulation. But I wouldn't call it a trick, and it's certainly not a mere game.
What is it then?
What this reveal does And what is genuinely brilliant about stepping back and looking at the series as a whole is that it proves the relationship between the written word and the physical form is deliberately frictional.
Frictional how? What do you mean by that?
Think of Adolescent Day not as a portrait, but as a conceptual threshold. The painting itself, the dried acrylic, doesn't actually impose a meaning on you. Rather, it exposes us. It exposes the viewer.
It holds up a mirror, but not to society. To us.
Yes, a mirror to our own cognitive processes. What this series reveals is our desperate, innate inability to tolerate pure abstract chaos. Yeah, when you look at Adolescent Day, without the explicit conceptual framing of its title, it is just layers of expanding polymers and sinking heavy pigments. It's just a chemical reaction.
Right.
But the human mind cannot handle that silence. We cannot look at chaos and just let it be chaos. We struggle, we panic, we frantically search for meaning.
We need to see the face in the water stain.
Exactly. We need that anchor, the word adolescente, to give ourselves permission to turn a chemical reaction on a piece of cotton fabric into a profound mirror of human identity.
So by naming the first one with this heavy emotional anchor and then completely pulling the rug out and naming the next one Buga, he's showing us our own desperation.
Exactly. He's reminding you, I control the anchor. I drop the word, and your brain does all the rest.
That is wild. So the art isn't actually the dried paint on the canvas. The art is the psychological experiment being run in real time on the person standing in the gallery looking at it.
Precisely. The vibrating tension between what is physically there and what you are desperate to see that is the artwork.
Which really brings us to the core takeaway of this whole deep dive. The enduring magnetic fascination of Adolescente doesn't actually lie in whether it perfectly sociologically represents a lonely teenager whose parents work too much.
No, not at all.
And it doesn't lie in whether it's just a fantastic textbook example of fluid dynamics and chemical displacement. Its real power lies in its unresolved dialogue. It's the constant, unavoidable tension between the physical, material accident of liquid pouring and the conscious, highly intellectual gesture of giving that liquid a name.
It is a stunning reminder of how our own brains navigate reality every single day.
Yeah.
Identity, meaning physical reality, they do not exist in separate silos. They happen simultaneously in the exact same space. We are always caught, constantly oscillating between what is organically emerging from the chaos of life and what is dissolving back into it.
It makes you question every piece of abstract art you've ever seen, honestly. So as we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you with a final lingering question to mull over on your own.
It's a good one.
Think back to that damp concrete wall from the very beginning. If applying a specific title, like a tragic stage of life, or a random Colombian town, completely rewires how our brains process a chaotic pour of paint, what would happen if the artist eventually stripped the titles away entirely?
Just took them all away.
Right. If you walked into a gallery tomorrow and every single painting was just labeled untitled, what would happen? Would the raw physical reality of the paint, the heavy sinking colors and the expanding polymers finally be allowed to speak for itself?
Or would we just panic again?
Exactly. Is the human mind so deeply afraid of pure chaos, so terrified of facing an unpredictable, meaningless world, that we would just tirelessly, endlessly invent new stories to fill the silence?